His head throbbed. The blur is real, he decided, as he cleaned the last of the smear from the second lens. It was an overlay, like the false grays and browns the program must use to hide that green field and this blue sky dotted with puffy white. They were hiding from them a world so beautiful. Holston had to concentrate to not just stand still and gape at it. He worked on the second of the four cameras and thought about those untrue walls beneath him, taking what they saw and modifying it. He wondered how many people in the silo knew. Any of them? What kind of fanatical devotion would it take to maintain this depressing illusion? Or was this a secret from before the last uprising? Was it an unknown lie perpetuated through the generations, a fibbing set of programs that continued to hum away on the silo computers with nobody aware? Because if someone knew, if they could show anything, why not something nice? The uprisings. Maybe it was just to prevent them from happening over and over again. Holston applied an ablative of film on the second sensor and wondered if the ugly lie of an unpleasant outside world was some misguided attempt to keep people from wanting out. Could someone have decided that the truth was worse than a loss of power, of control? Or was it something deeper and more sinister? A fear of unabashed, free, many-as-you-like children. So many horrible possibilities. And what of Allison? Where was she? Holston shuffled around the corner of the concrete tower toward the third lens, and the familiar but strange skyscrapers in the distant city came into view. Only there were more buildings than usual there. Some stood to either side, and an unfamiliar one loomed in the foreground. The others, the ones he knew by heart, were whole and shining, not twisted and jagged. Holston gazed over the crest of the verdant hills and imagined Allison would be walking over them at any minute. But that was ridiculous. How would she know he'd been expelled on this day? Would she remember the anniversary, even after he'd missed the last two? Holston cursed his former cowardice, the years wasted. He would have to go to her, he decided. He had a sudden impulse to do just that, to tear off his helmet and bulky suit and scamper up the hill in nothing but his carbon undersuit, breathing in deep gulps of crisp air and laughing all the way to his waiting wife in some vast, unfathomable city full of people and squealing children. But no, there were appearances to keep, illusions to maintain. He wasn't sure why, but it was what his wife had done, what all the other cleaners before him had done. Holston was now a member of that club, a member of the out-group. There was a press of history, of precedent to obey. They had known best. He would complete his performance for the in-group he had just joined. He wasn't sure why he was doing it, only that everyone before him had, and look at the secret they all shared. That secret was a powerful drug. He only knew to do what he had been told, to follow the numbers on the pockets, to mechanically clean while he considered the awesome implications of an outside world so big one couldn't live to see it all, couldn't breathe all the air, drink all the water, eat all the food. Holston dreamed of such things while he scrubbed, dutifully, on the third lens, wiped, applied, sprayed, then moved to the last. His pulse was audible in his ears. His chest pounded in that constricting suit. Soon, soon, he told himself. He used the second wool pad and polished the grime off the final lens. He wiped and applied and sprayed a final time, then put everything back in its place, back in the numbered pouches, not wanting to bespoil the gorgeous and healthy ground before his feet. Done. Holston stepped back, took one last look into the nobodies not watching from the cafeteria and lounge, then, turned his back on those who had turned their backs on Allison and all the others before her. There was a reason nobody came back for the inside people, Holston thought, just as there was a reason everyone cleaned, even when they said they wouldn't. He was free. He was to join the others, and so he strolled toward that dark crease that ran up the hill, following in his wife's footsteps, aware that some familiar boulder, long sleeping, no longer lay there. That, too, Holston decided, had been nothing more than another awful lie. 7. Holston was a dozen paces up the hill, still marveling at the bright grass at his feet and the brilliant sky above, when the first pang lurched in his stomach. It was a writhing cramp, something like intense hunger. At first he worried he was going too fast, first with the cleaning and now with his impatient shuffling in that cumbersome suit. He didn't want to take it off until he was over the hill, out of sight, maintaining whatever illusion the walls in the cafeteria held. He focused on the tops of the skyscrapers and resigned himself to slowing down, to calming down, one step at a time. Years and years of running up and down 30 flights of stairs should make this nothing. Another cramp, stronger this time. Holston winced and stopped walking, waiting for it to pass. When did he eat last? Not all yesterday, stupid. When did he last use the bathroom? Again, he couldn't remember. He might need to get the suit off earlier than he'd hoped. Once the wave of nausea passed, he took a few more steps, hoping to reach the top of the hill before the next bout of pain. He only got another dozen steps in before it hit him, more severe this time, worse than anything he'd ever felt. Holston retched from the intensity of it, and now his dry stomach was a blessing. He clutched his abdomen as his knees gave out in a shiver of weakness. He crashed to the ground and groaned. His stomach was burning, his chest on fire. He managed to crawl forward a few feet, sweat dripping from his forehead and splashing on the inside of his helmet. He saw sparks in his vision. The entire world went bright white several times like lightning strikes. Confused and senseless, he crawled ever upward, moving laboriously, his startled mind still focused on his last clear goal, cresting that hill. Again and again his view shimmered, his visor letting in solid bright light before it flickered away. It became difficult to see. Holston ran into something before him and his arms collapsed. He blinked and gazed forward up the hill, waiting for a clear sight of what lay ahead, but saw only infrequent strobes of green grass. And then his vision went away completely. All was black. Holston clawed at his face, even as his stomach tangled in a new torturous knot. There was a glow, a blinking in his vision, so he knew he wasn't blind, but the blinking seemed to be coming from inside his helmet. He could see the blinking. It was his visor that had become suddenly blind, not him. Holston felt for the latches on the back of the helmet. He wondered if he'd used up all his air. Was he asphyxiating? Being poisoned by his own exhalations? Of course! Why would they give him more air than he needed for the cleaning? He fumbled for the latches with his bulky gloves. They weren't meant for this. The gloves were part of the suit. His suit, a single piece, zipped up twice in the back and velcroed over. It wasn't meant to come off, not without help. Holston was going to die in it, poison himself, choke on his own gases, and now he knew true fear of containment, a true sense of being closed in. The silo was nothing to this as he scrambled for release, as he writhed in pain inside his tailored coffin. He squirmed and pounded at the latches, but his padded fingers were too big. And the blindness made it worse, made him feel smothered and trapped. Holston retched, again in pain. He doubled over, hands spread in the dirt, and felt something through his glove, a poke. He fumbled for the object and found it, a sharp rock, a tool. Holston tried to calm himself, His years of enforcing calm, of soothing others, of bringing stability to chaos came back to him. He gripped the rock carefully, terrified of losing it to his blindness, and brought it up to his helmet. There was a brief thought of cutting away his gloves with the rock, but he wasn't sure his sanity or air would last that long. He jabbed the point of the rock at his armored neck, right where the latch should be. He heard the crack as it landed. Crack! Crack! Pausing to probe with padded finger, retching again, Holston took more careful aim. There was a click instead of a crack. A sliver of light intruded as one side of the helmet came free. Holston was choking on his exhalations, on the stale and used air around him. He moved the rock to his other hand and aimed for the second latch. Two more cracks before it landed, the helmet popping free. Holston could see. His eyes burned from the effort, from not being able to breathe, but he could see. He blinked the tears away and tried to suck in a deep, crisp, revitalizing lungful of blue air. What he got instead was like a punch to the chest. Holston gagged. He threw up spittle and stomach acid, the very lining of him trying to flee. The world around him had gone brown. Brown grass and gray skies. No green. No blue. No life. He collapsed to one side, landing on his shoulder. His helmet lay open before him, the visor black and lifeless. There was no looking through the visor. Holston reached for it, confused. The outside of the visor was coated silver. The other side was nothing. No glass. A rough surface. Wires leading in and out of it. A display gone dark. Dead pixels. He threw up again. Wiping his mouth feebly, looking down the hill, he saw the world with his naked eyes as it was, as he'd always known it to be, desolate and bleak. He let go of the helmet, dropping the lie he had carried out of the silo with him. He was dying. The toxins were eating him from the inside. He blinked up at the black clouds overhead, roaming like beasts. He turned to see how far he had gotten, how far it was to the crest of the hill, and he saw the thing he had stumbled into while crawling, a boulder, sleeping. It hadn't been there in his visor, hadn't been a part of the lie on that little screen running one of the programs Allison had found. Holston reached out and touched the object before him, the white suit flaking away like brittle rock. And he could no longer support his head. Collapsing to the ground, curling up in pain from the slow death overtaking him, he held what remained of his wife and thought, with his last thought, what this death of his must look like to those who could see, this curling and dying in the black crack of a lifeless brown hill, a rotting city standing silent and forlorn over him. What would they see? Anyone who had chosen to watch?
Wool, Part 2. Proper Gauge. 1. Her knitting needles rested in a leather pouch in pairs, two matching sticks of wood, side by side, like the delicate bones of the wrist wrapped in dried and ancient flesh. Wood and leather. Artifacts like clues handed down from generation to generation. Innocuous winks from her ancestors. Harmless things like children's books and wood carvings that managed to survive the uprising and the purge. Each clue stood as a small hint of a world beyond their own. A world where buildings stood above ground like the crumbling ruins visible over the gray and lifeless hills. After much deliberation, Mère Jeanne selected a pair of needles. She always chose carefully, for proper gauge was critical. Too small a needle, and the knitting would prove difficult, the resulting sweater too tight and constricting. Too large a needle, on the other hand, and it would create a garment full of large holes. The knitting would remain loose. One would be able to see straight through it. Her choice made, the wooden bones removed from their leather wrist, Jeanne's reached for the large ball of cotton yarn. It was hard to believe, weighing that knot of twisted fibers, that her hands could make of it something ordered, something useful. She fished for the end of the yarn, dwelling on how things came to be. Right now, her sweater was little more than a tangle and a thought. Going back, it had once been bright fibers of cotton blooming in the dirt farms, pulled, cleaned, and twisted into long strands. Even further, and the very substance of the cotton plant itself could be traced to those souls who had been laid to rest in its soil, feeding the roots with their own leather, while the air above baked under the full glory of powerful grow lights. Jeanne's shook her head at her own morbidity. The older she got, the quicker her mind went to death. Always, in the end, the thoughts of death. With practiced care, she looped the end of the yarn around the point of one needle and crafted a triangle-shaped web with her fingers. The tip of the needle danced through this triangle, casting the yarn on. This was her favorite part, casting on. She liked beginnings, the first row. Out of nothing comes something. Since her hands knew what to do, she was free to glance up and watch a gust of morning wind chase pockets of dust down the slope of a hill. The clouds were low and ominous today. They loomed like worried parents over these smaller, darting clouds of wind-swept soil, which tumbled like laughing children, twirling and spilling, following the dips and valleys as they flowed toward a great crease where two hills collided to become one. Here, Jeanne's watched as the puffs of dust splashed against a pair of dead bodies, the frolicking twins of dirt evaporating into ghosts, solid, playful children returning once more to dreams and scattered mist. Mère Jeanne settled back in her faded plastic chair and watched the fickle winds play across the forbidding world outside. Her hands worked the yarn into rows, requiring only occasional glances to keep her place. Often the dust flew toward the silo's sensors in sheets, each wave causing her to cringe as if a physical blow were about to land. This assault of blurring grime was any time difficult to watch, but especially brutal the day after a cleaning. Each touch of dust on the clouding lenses was a violation, a dirty man touching something pure. Jeanne's remembered what that felt like. And 60 years later, she sometimes wondered if this misting of grime that led to a different sort of bodily sacrifice wasn't even more painful for her to abide.
Ma'am?
Mayor Jeanne's turned away from the sight of the dead hills cradling her recently deceased sheriff. She turned to find Deputy Marnes standing by her side.
Yes, Marnes.
Will you ask for these?
Marnes placed three manila folders on the cafeteria table and slid them toward her through the scattered crumbs and juice stains of last night's cleaning celebration. Jeanne set her knitting aside and reluctantly reached for the folders. What she really wanted was to be left alone a little longer to watch rows of knots become something. She wanted to enjoy the peace and quiet of this unspoiled sunrise, before the grime and the years dulled it, before the rest of the upper silo awoke, rubbed the sleep from their eyes and the stains from their consciences, and came up to crowd around her in their own plastic chairs and take it all in. But duty beckoned. She was mayor by choice, and the silo needed a sheriff. So Jeanne's put aside her own wants and desires and weighed the folders in her lap. Caressing the cover of the first one, she looked down at her hands with something between pain and acceptance. The back of them appeared as dry and crinkled as the pulp paper hanging out of the folders. She glanced over at Deputy Marnes, whose white mustache was flecked with the occasional black. She remembered when the colors there were the other way around. She remembered when his tall and thin frame was a mark of vigor and youth rather than gaunt fragility. He was handsome still, but only because she knew him from so long ago, only because her old eyes still remembered.
"You know," she told Marnes, "we could do this different this time. You could let me promote you to sheriff, hire yourself a deputy, and do this proper."
Marnes laughed.
"Well, I've been deputy almost as long as you've been mayor, ma'am. Don't figure on being nothing else but dead one day."
Jeanne nodded. One of the things she loved about having Marnes around was that his thoughts could be so black as to make hers shine gray.
"Well, I feel that day is rapidly approaching for us both," she said.
"Truer than true, I reckon. Never figured to outlive so many. Sure as sin don't see me outliving you."
Marnes rubbed his mustache and studied the view of the outside. Jeanne smiled at him, opened the folder on top, and studied the first bio.
"Well, that's three decent candidates," Marnes said, "just like you asked for. I'd be happy to work with any of them. Juliet, I think she's in the middle there, would be my first pick. Works down in mechanical. You don't come up much, but me and Holston..."
Marnes paused and cleared his throat. Jeanne glanced over and saw that her deputy's gaze had crept toward that dark crook in the hill. He covered his mouth with a fist of sharp knuckles and faked a cough.
"Excuse me," he said. "As I was saying, the sheriff and me worked to death down there a few years back. This Juliet, I think she prefers Jules, come to think of it, was a right shiner. Sharp as a tack. Big help on the case. Good at spotting details, handling people, being diplomatic but firm, all that. I don't think she comes up past the 80s much. Down deeper for sure, which we ain't had in a while."
Jeanne sorted through Juliet's folder, checking her family tree, her voucher history, her current pay and chits. She was listed as a shift foreman with good marks. No history in the lottery.
"Never married?" Jeanne asked.
"Nope, something of a John boy, a wrencher, you know. We were down there a week, saw how the guys took to her. Now, she could have her pick of them boys, but chooses not to. Kind of person who leaves an impression, but prefers to go it alone."
"Well, Joel seems like she left an impression on you," Jeanne said, regretting it immediately.
She hated the jealous tone in her own voice. Marnes shifted his weight to his other foot.
"Well, you know me, Mayor. I'm always sizing up candidates. Anything to keep from being promoted."
Jeanne smiled.
"What about the other two?"
She checked the names, wondering if a down deeper was a good idea, or possibly worried about Marnes having a crush. She recognized the name on the top folder, Peter Billings. He worked a few floors down in judicial, as a clerk or a judge's shadow.
"Well, honestly, ma'am, they're filler, to make it seem fair. Like I said, I'd work with them, but I think Jules is your girl. It's been a long time since we had a lass for a sheriff. Be a popular choice with an election coming up."
"Well, that won't be why we choose," Jeanne said. "Whoever we decide on will probably be here long after we're gone."
She stopped herself as she recalled having said the same thing about Holston, back when he'd been chosen. Jeanne closed the folder and returned her attention to the wall screen. A small tornado had formed at the base of the hill. The gathering dust whipped into an organized frenzy. It built some steam, this small wisp, as it swelled into a larger cone, spinning and spinning on a wavering tip like a child's top as it raced toward sensors that fairly sparkled in the wan rays of a clear sunrise.
"Well, I think we should go see her," Jeanne finally said.
She kept the folders in her lap, fingers like rolled parchment toying with the rough edges of handmade paper.
"Well, ma'am, I'd rather us fetch her up here. Do the interview in your office like we always done. It's a long way down to her, an even longer way back up."
"I appreciate the concern, deputy, I do. But it's been a long while since I've been much past the 40th. My knees are no excuse to not see my people."
The mayor stopped. The tornado of dust wavered, turned, and headed straight for them. It grew and grew, the wide angle of the lens distorting it into a monster much larger and more fierce than she knew it to actually be. And then it blew over the sensor array, the entire cafeteria descending into a brief darkness until the Zephyr caromed past, retreating across the screen in the lounge and leaving behind it a view of the world now tainted with a slight, dingy film.
"Damn those things," Deputy Marin said through gritted teeth.
The aged leather of his holster squeaked as he rested his hand on the butt of his gun, and Jeans imagined the old deputy out on that landscape, chasing the wind on thin legs while pumping bullets into a cloud of fading dust. The two of them sat silent a moment, surveying the damage. Finally, Jeans spoke.
"Well, the trip won't be about the election, Mons. It won't be for votes, either. For all I know, I'll run again unopposed. So we won't make a deal of it, and we'll travel light and quiet. I want to see my people, not be seen by them."
She looked over at him, found that he was watching her.
"It'll be for me, Mons, a getaway."
She turned back to the view.
Sometimes I just think I've been up here too long. The both of us. I think we've been anywhere too long."
The ringing of morning footsteps on the spiral staircase gave her pause, and they both turned toward the sound of life, the sound of a waking day. And she knew it was time to start getting the images of dead things out of her mind, or at least to bury them a while.
"We'll go down and get us a proper gauge of this Juliet, you and me. Because sometimes, sitting here, looking out on what the world makes us do, it needles me deep, Mons. It needles me straight through."
They met after breakfast in Holston's old office. Jeans still thought of it as his, a day later. It was too early for her to think of the room as anything else. She stood beyond the twin desks and old filing cabinets and peered into the empty holding cell while Deputy Marnes gave last-minute instructions to Terry, a security worker from IT who often held down the fort while Marnes and Holston were away on a case. Standing dutifully behind Terry was a teenager named Marcha, a young girl with dark hair and bright eyes who was apprenticing for work in IT. She was Terry's shadow. Just about half the silo had one. They ranged in age from 12 to 20, these ever-present sponges absorbing the lessons and techniques for keeping the silo operational one generation more. Deputy Marnes reminded Terry how rowdy people got after a cleaning. Once the tension was released, people tended to live it up a little. Most of them were too young to remember the last double cleaning, so they thought it couldn't happen. They thought, for a few moments at least, that anything went. The warning hardly needed saying. The revelry in the next room could be heard through the shut door. Most residents from the top 40 were already packed into the cafeteria and lounge. Hundreds more from the mids and the down deep would trickle up throughout the day, asking off work and turning in holiday chits just to see the mostly clear view. It was a pilgrimage for many. Some only came up once every few years, stood around for an hour, muttering that it looked the same as they remembered, then shooing their children down the stairs ahead of them, fighting the upward surging crowds. Terry was left with the keys and a temporary badge. Marnes checked the batteries in his wireless, made sure the volume on the office unit was up, and inspected his gun. He shook Terry's hand and wished him luck. Jean sensed it was almost time for them to go and turned away from the empty cell. She said goodbye to Terry, gave Marcha a nod, and followed Marnes out the door.
"You feel okay leaving right after a cleaning?" she asked as they stepped out into the cafeteria.
She knew how rowdy it would get later that night, and how testy the crowd. It seemed an awful time to drag him away on a mostly selfish errand.
"Are you kidding? I need this. I need to get away."
He glanced toward the wall screen, which was obscured by the crowds.
"I still can't figure what Holston was thinking. Can't reckon why he never talked to me about all that was going on in that head of his. Maybe by the time we get back I won't feel him in the office anymore, 'cause right now I can't hardly breathe in there."
Jeans thought about this as they fought through the crowd. plastic cup sloshed with a mix of fruit juices, and she smelled the sting of tub-brewed alcohol in the air, but ignored it. People were wishing her well, asking her to be careful, promising to vote. News of their trip had leaked out faster than the spiked punch, despite hardly telling anyone. Most were under the impression that it was a goodwill trip, a re-election campaign. The younger silo residents, who only remembered Holston as sheriff, were already saluting Marnes and giving him that honorific title. Anyone with wrinkles in their eyes knew better. They nodded to the duo as they passed through the cafeteria and wished them a different sort of unspoken luck. "Keep us going," their eyes said. "Make it so my kids live as long as me. Don't let it unravel, not just yet." Jean's lived under the weight of this pressure, a burden brutal on more than knees. She kept quiet as they made their way to the central stairwell. A handful called for her to make a speech, but the lone voices did not gain traction. No chant formed, much to her relief. What would she say? That she didn't know why it all held together? That she didn't even understand her own knitting? How if you made knots, and if you did it right, things just worked out? Would she tell them it only took one snip for it all to unravel? One cut, and you could pull and pull and turn that garment into a pile. Did they really expect her to understand, when all she did was follow the rules, and somehow it kept working out, year after year after year? Because she didn't understand what held it together. And she didn't understand their mood, this celebration. Were they drinking and shouting because they were safe? Because they'd been spared by fate, passed over for cleaning? Her people cheered, while a good man, her friend, her partner in keeping them alive and well, lay dead on a hill next to his wife. If she gave a speech, if it weren't full of the forbidden, it would be this: that no two better people had ever gone to cleaning of their own free wills. And what did that say about the lot of them who remained? Now was not the time for speeches, or for drinking, or for being merry. Now was the hour of quiet contemplation, which was one of the reasons Jeanne knew she needed to get away. Things had changed, not just by the day, but by the long years. She knew better than most. Maybe old Lady McNeil down in supply knew, could see it coming. One had to live a long time, to be sure, but now she was. And as time marched on, carrying her world faster and faster than her feet could catch up, Mayor Jeanne's knew that it would soon leave her completely behind. And her great fear, unspoken but daily felt, was that this world probably wouldn't stagger very far along without her. 2. Jeanne's walking stick made a conspicuous ring as it impacted each metal step. It soon became a metronome for their descent, timing the music of the stairwell, which was crowded and vibrating with the energy of a recent cleaning. All the traffic, save for the two of them, seemed to be heading upward. They jostled against the flow, elbows brushing, cries of, "Hey, Mayor!" followed by nods to Marnes, and Jeanne saw it on their faces. The temptation to call him sheriff, tempered by their respect for the awful nature of his assumed promotion.
"How many floors are you up for?" Marnes asked.
"Why, you tired already?"
Jeanne glanced over her shoulder to smirk at him, saw his bushy mustache twisted up in a smile of his own.
"Going down ain't a problem for me. It's the going back up I can't stand."
Their hands briefly collided on the twisted railing of the spiral staircase, Jeanne's hand trailing behind her, Marnes's reaching ahead. She felt like telling him she wasn't tired at all, but she did feel a sudden weariness, an exhaustion more mental than physical. She had a childish vision of more youthful times, and pictured Marnes scooping her up and carrying her down the staircase in his arms. There would be a sweet release of strength and responsibility, a sinking into another's power, no need to feign her own. This was not a remembrance of the past. It was a future that had never happened. And Jeanne's felt guilty for even thinking it. She felt her husband beside her, his ghost perturbed by her thoughts.
Mayor, how many are you thinking?
The two of them stopped and hugged the rail as a porter trudged up the stairs. Jeanne's recognized the boy, Connor, still in his teens but already with a strong back and steady stride. He had an array of bundles strapped together and balanced on his shoulders. The sneer on his face was not from exhaustion or pain, but annoyance. Who were all these people suddenly on his stairwell, these tourists? Jeanne's thought of something encouraging to say, some small verbal reward for these people who did a job her knees never could, but he was already gone on his strong young feet, carrying food and supplies up from the down deep, slowed only by the crush of traffic attempting to worm up through the silo for a peek of the clear and wide outside. She and Marnes caught their breath for a moment between flights. Marnes handed her his canteen, and she took a polite sip before passing it back.
"I'd like to do half today," she finally answered, "but I want to make a few stops on the way."
Marnes took a swig of water and began twisting the cap back on.
"For house calls?"
"Something like that. I want to stop at the nursery on 20.
Marnes laughed.
"Kissing babies? Mayor, ain't nobody going to vote you out, not at your age."
Jeanne's didn't laugh. "Thanks," she said with a mask of false pain. "But no, not to kiss babies." She turned her back and resumed walking. Marnes followed.
"It's not that I don't trust your professional opinion about this Jules lady. You haven't picked anything but a winner since I've been mayor."
"Even,"
Marnes interrupted.
"Especially him," Jeanne said, knowing what he was thinking. "He was a good man, but he had a broken heart. That'll take even the best of 'em down."
Marnes grunted his agreement.
"So what are we checking at the nursery? Miss Juliet weren't born on the 20th, not if I recall."
"No, but her father works there now. I thought since we were passing by that we'd get a feel for the man, get some insight on his daughter."
"A father for a character witness?" Marnes laughed. "Well, don't reckon you'll get much of an impartial there."
"Well, I think you'll be surprised," Jeanne said. "I had Alice do some digging while I was packing. She found something interesting."
"Yeah?"
"Well, this Juliet character still has every vacation chit she's ever earned."
"Well, that ain't rare for mechanical," Marnes said. "They do a lot of overtime."
"Not only does she not get out, she doesn't have visitors."
"Well, I still don't see where you're going."
Jeanne's waited while a family passed. A young boy, 6 or 7 probably, rode on his father's shoulders, his head stooped to avoid the undersides of the stairs above. The mother brought up the rear, an overnight bag draped over her shoulder, a swaddled infant cradled in her arms. It was the perfect family, Jeanne's thought, replacing what they took. 2 for 2. Just what the lottery aimed for and sometimes provided.
"Well, then, let me tell you where I'm going with this," she told Marnes. "I want to find this girl's father, look him in the eyes, and ask him why, in the nearly 20 years since his daughter moved to mechanical, he hasn't visited her, not once."
She looked back at Marnes, saw him frowning at her beneath his mustache.
"And why she hasn't once made her way up to see him," she added.
The traffic thinned as they made their way into the teens and past the upper apartments. With each step down, Jeanne's dreaded having to reclaim those lost inches on the way back up. This was the easy part, she reminded herself. The descent was like the uncoiling of a steel spring, pushing her down. It reminded Jeanne's of nightmares she'd had of drowning. Silly nightmares, considering she'd never seen enough water to submerge herself in, much less enough that she couldn't stand to breathe. But they were like the occasional dreams of falling from great heights, some legacy of another time, broken fragments unearthed in each of their sleeping minds that suggested, we weren't supposed to live like this. And so, the descent, this spiraling downward, was much like the imagined drowning that swallowed her at night. It felt inexorable and inextricable, like a weight pulling her down combined with the knowledge that she'd never be able to claw her way back up. They passed the garment district next, the land of multicolored coveralls and the place her balls of yarn came from. The smell of the dyes and other chemicals drifted over the landing. A window cut into the curving cinder blocks looked through to a small food shop at the edge of the district. It had been ransacked by the crowds, shelves emptied by the crushing demand of exhausted hikers and the extra post-cleaning traffic. Several porters crowded up the stairs with heavy loads, trying their best to satisfy demand, and Jeanne's recognized an awful truth about yesterday's cleaning. The barbaric practice brought more than psychological relief, more than just a clear view of the outside. It also buttressed the silo's economy. There was suddenly an excuse to travel, an excuse to trade. And, as gossip flowed, and family and old friends met again for the first time in months or perhaps years, there was a vitality injected into the entire silo. It was like an old body stretching and loosening its joints, blood flowing to the extremities. A decrepit thing was becoming alive again.
Mayor!
She turned to find Marnes almost out of sight around the spiral above her. She paused while he caught up, watching his feet as he hurried.
Easy, he said. I can't keep up if you take off like that.
Jeanne apologized. She hadn't been aware of any change in her pace. As they entered the second tier of apartments, down below the 16th floor, Jeanne realized she was already in territory she hadn't seen in almost a year. There was the rattle, here, of younger legs chasing along the stairwell, getting tangled up in the slow climbers. The grade school for the upper third was just above the nursery. From the sound of all the traffic and voices, school had been canceled. Jeanne imagined it was a combination of knowing how few would turn up for class, with parents taking their kids up to the view, plus how many teachers would want to do the same. They passed the landing for the school, where chalk games of hop and square four were blurred from the day's traffic, where kids sat, hugging the rails, skinned knees poking out, feet swinging below the jutting landings, and where catcalls and eager shouts faded to secret whispers in the presence of adults.
"I'm glad we're almost there. I need a rest," Marnes said,
as they spiraled down one more flight to the nursery.
"I just hope this feller is available to see us."
"Oh, he will be," Jeanne said. "Alice wired him from my office that we were coming."
They crossed traffic at the nursery landing and caught their breath. When Marnes passed his canteen, Jeanne's took a long pull and then checked her hair in its curved and dented surface.
"You look fine," he said.
"Mayoral,"
he laughed.
"And then some."
Jeanne thought she saw a twinkle in his old, brown eyes when he said this, but it was probably the light bouncing off the canteen as he brought it to his lips.
20 floors in just over 2 hours. I don't recommend the pace, but I'm glad we're this far already.
He wiped his mustache and reached around to try and slip the canteen back into his pack.
"Well, here," Jeanne said.
She took the canteen from him and slid it into the webbed pouch on the rear of his pack.
"And let me do the talking in there," she reminded him.
Marnes lifted his arms and showed his palms, as if no other thought had ever crossed his mind. He stepped past her and pulled one of the heavy metal doors open, the customary squeal of rusted hinges not coming as expected. The silence startled Jeanne's. She was used to hearing the chirp of old doors all up and down the staircase as they opened and closed. They were the stairwell's version of the wildlife found in the farms, ever present and always singing. But these hinges were coated in oil, rigorously maintained. The signs on the walls of the waiting room reinforced the observation. They demanded silence in bold letters, accompanied by pictures of fingers over lips and circles with slashes through open mouths. The nursery evidently took their quietude seriously.
"I don't remember so many signs last time I was here," Marnes whispered.
"Well, maybe you were too busy yapping to notice," Jeanne replied.
A nurse glared at them through a glass window, and Jeanne elbowed Marnes.
"Mayor Jean's to see Peter Nichols," she told the woman.
The nurse behind the window didn't blink.
"I know who you are. I voted for you."
"Oh, of course. Well, thank you."
"If you'll come around."
The woman hit a button on her desk, and the door beside her buzzed faintly. Marnes pushed on the door, and Jean's followed him through.
"If you'll don these."
The nurse, Margaret, according to the hand-drawn tag on her collar, held out two neatly folded white cloth robes. Jeanne accepted them both and handed one to Marnes.
"You can leave your bags with me."
There was no refusing Margaret. Jeanne felt at once that she was in this much younger woman's world, that she had become her inferior when she passed through that softly buzzing door. She leaned her walking stick against the wall, took her pack off, and lowered it to the ground, and then shrugged on the robe. Marnes struggled with his until Margaret helped, holding the sleeve in place. He wrestled the robe over his denim shirt and held the loose ends of the long fabric waist tie as if its working was beyond his abilities. He watched Jean's, not hers, and finally made enough of a mess of it for the robe to hold fairly together.
"What?"
he asked, noticing the way Jean's was watching him.
"This is what I got cuffs for, so I never learned to tie a knot, so what?"
"In 60 years,
Jean said. Margaret pressed another button on her desk and pointed down the hall.
"Dr. Nichols is in the nursery. I'll let him know you're coming."
Jean led the way. Marnes followed, asking her,
"Why is that so hard to believe?"
"Well, I think it's cute, actually."
Marnes snorted.
"That's an awful word to use on a man of my age."
Jeanne smiled to herself. At the end of the hall, she paused before a set of double doors before pushing them open a crack. The light in the room beyond was dim. She opened the door further, and they entered a sparse but clean waiting room. She remembered a similar one from the mid-levels, where she had waited with a friend to be reunited with her child. A glass wall looked into a room that held a handful of cribs and bassinets. It was too dark inside to see if any of the small beds stirred with newborns. Jeanne's, of course, was notified of every birth, signed a letter of congratulations and a birth certificate for each one, but the names ran together with the days. She could rarely remember what level the parents lived on, if it was their first or second. It made her sad to admit it, but those certificates had just become more paper for her to sign. The shadowy outline of an adult moved among the small cribs, the shiny clamp of a clipboard and the flash of a metal pen winking from the light of the observation room. The dark shape was obviously tall, with the gait and build of a man. He took his time, noting something as he hovered over a crib, the two shimmers of metal uniting to jot a note. When he was done, he crossed the room and passed through a wide door to join Marnes and Jeanne's in the waiting room. Peter Nichols was an imposing man, Jeanne saw, tall and lean, but not like Marnes, who seemed to fold and unfold unsure limbs to move about. Peter was lean like a habitual exerciser, like a few porters Jeanne's knew who could take the stairs two at a time and make it look like they'd been expressly designed for such a gait. It was height that lent confidence. Jeanne could feel it as she took Peter's outstretched hand, his grip firm but not showy.
"You came,"
Dr. Nichols said, simply. It was a cold observation. There was only a hint of surprise. He shook Marnes's hand, but his eyes returned to Jeanne's.
"I explained to your secretary that I wouldn't be much help. I'm afraid I haven't seen Juliet since she became a shadow 20 years ago."
"Well, that's exactly what I wanted to talk to you about."
Jeanne's glanced at the cushioned benches where she imagined anxious grandparents, aunts, and uncles waited, while parents were united with their newborns.
Could we sit?
Dr. Nichols nodded and waved them over.
I take each of my appointments for office very seriously, Johns explained, sitting across from the doctor. At my age, I expect most judges and lawmen I install to outlive me, so I choose carefully.
But they don't always, do they? Dr. Nichols tilted his head, no expression on his lean and carefully shaven face. Outlive you, I mean.
Jean swallowed. Marnes stirred on the bench beside her. You must value family, Jean said, changing the subject, realizing this was just another observation, no harm meant. To have shadowed so long and to choose such a demanding line of work.
Nichols nodded.
Why do you and Juliet never visit? I mean, not once in almost 20 years? She's your only child.
Nichols turned his head slightly, his eyes drifting to the wall. Jean's was momentarily distracted by the sight of another form moving behind the glass, a nurse making the rounds. Another set of doors led off to what she assumed were the delivery rooms, where a convalescing new mother right now was probably waiting to be handed her most precious possession.
I had a son as well, Dr. Nichols said.
Jean's felt herself reaching for her bag to procure the folders within, but it wasn't by her side. This was a detail she had missed. A brother?
You couldn't have known, Nichols said, correctly reading the shock on Mayor Jean's face. He didn't survive. Technically, he wasn't born. The lottery moved on.
I'm sorry.
She fought the urge to reach over and hold Marnes's hand. It had been decades since the two of them had purposefully touched, even innocently, but the sudden sadness in the room punctured that intervening time.
His name was going to be Nicholas, my father's father's name. He was born prematurely, 1 pound 8 ounces.
The clinical precision in his voice was somehow sadder than his processing any feelings might have been.
They intubated, moved him into an incubator, but there were complications.
Dr. Nichols looked down at the backs of his hands.
Juliet was 12 at the time. She was as excited as we were, if you can imagine, to have a baby brother on the way. She was 1 year out from shadowing her mother, who was a delivery nurse.
Nichols glanced up.
Not here in this nursery, mind you, but in the old mid-level nursery, where we both worked. I was still an intern then.
And Juliet?
Mayor Jean still didn't understand the connection.
There was a failure with the incubator. When Nicholas...
The doctor turned his head to the side and reached halfway to his eyes, but was able to compose himself.
I'm sorry, I still call him that.
It's okay.
Mayor Jean's was holding Deputy Marnes's hand. She wasn't sure when or how that had happened. The doctor didn't seem to notice, or more likely care.
Poor Juliet.
He shook his head.
She was distraught. She blamed Rhoda at first. This experienced delivery nurse who had done nothing but work a miracle to give our boy the slim chance he had. I explained this. I think Juliet knew. She just needed someone to hate.
He nodded to Jean's.
Girls that age, you know.
Believe it or not, I remember.
Jean's forced a smile and Dr. Nichols returned it. She felt Marnes squeeze her hand.
It wasn't until her mother died that she took to blaming the incubator that had failed. Well, not the incubator, but the poor condition it was in. The general state of rot all things become.
Your wife died from the complications?
It was another detail Jean's felt she must have missed from the file.
My wife killed herself a week later.
Again, the clinical detachment. Jean's wondered if this was a survival mechanism that had kicked in after these events, or a personality trait already in place.
It seems like I would remember that,
Deputy Marnes said, the first words he'd uttered since introducing himself to the doctor.
Well, I wrote the certificate myself, so I could put whatever cause I wanted.
And you admit to this?
Marnes seemed ready to leap off the bench. To do what, Jean's could hardly guess. She held his arm to keep him in place.
Beyond the statute of limitations? Of course. I admit it. It was a worthless lie, anyway. Juliet was smart, even at that age. She knew. and this is what drove her.
He stopped himself.
Drove her what? Mayor Jeans asked. Crazy?
No. Dr. Nichols shook his head. I wasn't going to say that. It's what drove her away. She applied for a change in casters, demanded to move down to mechanical, to enter the shop as a shadow. She was a year young for that sort of placement, but I agreed. I signed off on it. I thought she'd go, get some deep air, come back. I was naive. I thought the freedom would be good for her.
And you haven't seen her since?
Once, for her mother's funeral just a few days later. She marched up on her own, attended the burial, gave me a hug, then marched back down. All without rest, from what I've heard. I try to keep up with her. I have a colleague in the deep nursery who will wire now and then with a bit of news. It's all focus, focus, focus with her.
Nichols paused and laughed.
You know, when she was young, all I saw was her mother in her, but she grew up to be more like me.
Is there anything you know that would preclude her from or make her ill-suited for the job of silo sheriff? You do understand what's involved with the job, right?
I understand.
Nichols looked over at Marnes, his eye drifting to the copper badge visible through the open, shoddily tied robe, down to the bulge of a pistol at his side.
All the lawmen throughout the silos have to have someone up top, giving commands. Is that it?
More or less, Jean said.
Why her?
Marnes cleared his throat.
Well, she helped us with an investigation once.
Jules?
She was up here?
No, we were down there.
She has no training.
Well, none of us have,
Marnes said.
It's more of a political office, a citizen's post.
She won't agree to it.
Why not? Jeans asked.
Nichols shrugged. You'll see for yourself, I suppose.
He stood. I wish I could give you more time, but I really should get back. He glanced at the set of double doors. We'll be bringing a family in soon.
I understand.
Jeans rose and shook his hand.
I appreciate you seeing us.
He laughed.
Did I have a choice?
Well, of course.
Well, I wish I would have known that sooner.
He smiled, and Jean saw that he was joking, or attempting to. As they parted company and walked back down the hallway to collect their things and return the robes, Jean's found herself more and more intrigued by this nomination of Marnes. It wasn't his style, a woman from the down deep. A person with baggage? She wondered if his judgment was perhaps clouded by other factors. And, as he held the door for her, leading out to the main waiting room, Mayor Jeans wondered if she was going along with him because her judgment was clouded as well. 3. It was lunchtime, but neither of them was powerfully hungry. Jeans nibbled on a corn bar while she walked, priding herself on eating on the climb, like a porter. They continued to pass these tradesmen, and Jeans' esteem of their profession grew and grew. There was a strange pang of guilt to be heading down under such a light load while these men and women trudged up, carrying so much. And they moved so fast. She and Marnes pressed themselves against the rail as a downward porter apologetically stomped past. His shadow, a girl of 15 or 16, was right behind him, loaded down with what looked to be sacks of garbage for the recycling center. Jeans watched the young girl spiral out of sight, sinewy and smooth legs hanging miles out of her shorts, and felt suddenly very old and very tired. The two of them fell into a rhythmic pace, the reach of each foot hovering over the next tread, a sort of collapsing of the bones, a resignation to gravity, falling to that foot, sliding the hand, reaching the walking stick forward, repeat. Doubt crept into Jean's around the 30th floor. What seemed a fine adventure at sunrise now seemed a mighty undertaking. Each step was performed reluctantly, knowing how grueling it would be to win that elevation back. They passed the upper water treatment plant on 32, and Jean's realized she was seeing portions of the silo that were practically new to her. It had been a lifetime ago that she'd been this deep, a shameful thing to admit, and in that time, changes had been made, Construction and repair were ongoing. Walls were a different color than she remembered, but then it was hard to trust one's memory. The traffic on the stairs lightened as they neared the IT floors. Here were the most sparsely populated levels of the silo, where less than 24 men and women, but mostly men, operated within their own little kingdom. The silo servers took up almost an entire floor, the machines slowly rebuilding with recent history, having been wiped completely during the uprising. Access to them was now severely restricted, and as Jeanne's passed the landing on the 33rd, she swore she could hear the mighty thrumming of all the electricity they consumed. Whatever the silo had been, or had been designed for, she knew, without asking or being told, that these strange machines were some organ of primacy. Their power draw was a constant source of contention during budget meetings, but the necessity of the cleaning, the fear of even talking about the outside, and all the dangerous taboos that went with it gave IT incredible leeway. They housed the labs that made the suits, each one tailored to the person waiting in the holding cell, and this alone set them apart from all else. No, Jeanne's told herself, it wasn't simply the taboo of the cleaning, the fear of the outside. It was the hope. There was this unspoken, deadly hope in every member of the silo. A ridiculous, fantastical hope that maybe not for them, but perhaps for their children or their children's children, life on the outside would be possible once again, and that it would be the work of IT and the bulky suits that emerged from their labs that would make it all possible. Jeanne's felt a shiver even to think about it, living outside. The childhood conditioning was that strong. Maybe God would hear her thoughts and rat her out. She imagined herself in a cleaning suit, a far too common visual, placing herself into the flexible coffin into which she had condemned so many. On the 34th, she slipped off onto the landing. Marnes joined her, his canteen in hand. Jeanne's realized she'd been drinking out of his all day, while hers stayed strapped to her back. There was something childlike and romantic about this, but also something practical. It was more difficult to reach one's own water than it was to grab that of the other from their pack.
"Well, you need a break?"
He passed the canteen, which had but 2 swallows left in it. Jeanne's took one of them.
"Well, this is our next stop," she said.
Marnes looked up at the faded number stenciled over the doorway. He had to know what floor they were on, but it was as if he needed to double-check. Jeanne's returned his canteen.
"In the past, I've always wired them to get the okay on my nominations. It was something Mayor Humphreys did before me and Mayor Jeffers before him." She shrugged. "Way of the world."
"Well, I didn't know they had to approve."
He took the last swallow and patted Jeanne's on the back, twirled his finger for her to turn around.
"Well, they've never rejected any of my nominations."
Jeanne's felt her canteen tugged out of her pouch, Marnes's canteen shoved in its place. Her pack felt a smidgen lighter. She realized Marnes wanted to carry her water and share it until it, too, was empty.
"Well, I think the unwritten rule is there just so we'll carefully consider every judge and lawman, knowing there's some informal oversight."
"So this time you're doing it in person?"
She turned back around to face her deputy.
"I figured we were passing this way."
She paused while a young couple hurried up the stairs behind Marnes, holding hands and taking the treads 2 at a time.
"And that it might feel even more conspicuous to not stop and check in."
"Check in," Marnes said.
Jeanne's half expected him to spit over the railing. The tone seemed to require such punctuation. She suddenly felt another of her weaknesses exposed.
"Think of it as a goodwill mission," she said, turning toward the door.
"I'm going to think of it as a fact-finding raid," Marnes muttered, following her.
Unlike at the nursery, Jean's could tell that they would not be buzzed through and sent back into the mysterious depths of IT. While they waited to be seen, she watched as even a member of the staff, identifiable from their red coveralls, was patted down and searched just to leave the wing and exit toward the stairs. A man with a wand, like Terry, a member of IT's own internal security detail, seemed to have the job of checking everyone who passed through the metal gates. The receptionist on the outside of the gates was deferent enough and seemed pleased to have the mayor for a visit. She expressed her condolences for the recent cleaning, an odd thing to say, but something Jeanne wished she heard more often. They were shown to a small conference room attached to the main foyer, a place, she supposed, for meeting with various departments without putting them through the hassle of passing through security.
"Look at all this space,"
Marnes whispered, once they were alone in the room together.
"Did you see the size of the entrance hall?"
Jeanne nodded. She looked around the ceiling and walls for some peephole, something to confirm the creepy sensation that she was being watched. She set her bag and walking stick down and collapsed wearily into one of the plush chairs. When it moved, she realized the thing was on wheels, nicely oiled wheels.
"Always wanted to check this place out," Marnes said.
He peered through the glass window that looked back into the wide foyer.
"Every time I've passed this place, and it's only been a dozen times or so, I've been curious to see what's inside."
Jeanne nearly asked him to stop talking, but worried that it would hurt his feelings.
"Boy, he's coming in a hurry. Must be because of you."
Jeanne turned and looked out the window to see Bernard Holland heading their way. He disappeared from view as he approached the door. The handle flicked down, and the small man whose job it was to keep IT running smoothly strode into the room.
"Mayor."
Bernard was all teeth, the front ones crooked. He reached for Jeanne's hand as she rose from the chair, the blasted thing nearly scooting out from underneath her as she pressed down on the armrests.
"Oh, careful," Bernard said, grabbing her elbow to steady her. "Deputy,"
he nodded toward Marnes while Jeanne steadied herself.
"It's an honor to have you down. I know you don't take these trips often."
"Oh, thanks for seeing us on short notice," Jeanne said.
"Of course, of course. Please, make yourselves comfortable."
He swept his hand over the lacquered conference table. It was nicer than the one in the mayor's office, though Jeanne assuaged her envy by assuming it was shiny from being less frequently employed. She sat, approaching the chair warily, then reached into her bag and produced the set of files.
"Straight to business, as always,"
Bernard said, sitting beside her. He pushed his glasses up his nose and glided forward on the chair until his plump little belly met the desk.
"Always appreciated that about you. We are, as you can imagine with yesterday's unfortunate events, as busy as ever. Lots of data to go through."
"Well, how's that going?"
Jeanne asked, while she arranged the material in front of her.
"Some positives and negatives, as always. Readouts from some of the seal sensors showed improvement. Atmospheric levels of 8 of the known toxins have declined, though not by much. 2 have risen. Most have remained unchanged."
He waved his hand.
"It's a lot of boring technical stuff, but it'll all be in my report. I should have it boarded up before you get back to your office."
"Well, that'll be fine," Jeanne said.
She wanted to say something else, to acknowledge his department's hard work, to let him know that another cleaning had been successful, God knew why, but it was Holston out there, the closest thing she'd ever had to a shadow, the only man she ever saw running for her office when she was dead and feeding the roots of the fruit trees. It was too soon to mention it, much less applaud it.
"I'd normally wire this sort of thing to you," she said, "but since we were passing by and you won't be up for the next committee meeting for, what, another 3 months?
"The years go fast,"
Bernard said.
"I just figured we could informally agree to this now, so I could offer our best candidate the job."
She glanced up at Marnes.
"Once she accepts, we can finish the paperwork on our way back up, if you don't mind."
She slid the folder toward Bernard and was surprised when he produced one of his own, rather than accept hers.
"Well, let's go over this," Bernard said.
He opened his folder, licked his thumb, and flipped through a few pieces of high-quality paper.
"We were wired about your visit, but your list of candidates didn't hit my desk until this morning. Otherwise, I would have tried to save you the trip down and back up."
He pulled out a piece of paper, devoid of creases. It didn't even look bleached. Johns wondered where IT got such things while her office was held together with cornstarch paste.
"I'm thinking of the three names listed here, that Billings is our man."
"Well, we may consider him next,"
Deputy Marne started to say.
"I think we should consider him now."
He slid the paper toward Johns. It was an acceptance contract. There were signatures at the bottom. One line was left blank, the mayor's name neatly printed underneath. She had to catch her breath.
"You've already contacted Peter about this?" "Oh, he accepted. The judge's robe was going to be a little stifling for him, being so young and full of energy. I thought he was a fine choice for that role, but I think he's an even better one now for the job of sheriff."
Johns remembered Peter's nomination process. It had been one of the times she'd gone along with Bernard's suggestion, seeing it as a trade for a future pick of her own. She studied the signature, Peter's hand familiar from his various notes sent up on behalf of Judge Wilson. She imagined one of the porters who had flown past them on the steps that day, apologizing as they went, rushing this very piece of paper down.
"I'm afraid Peter is currently third on our list," Mayor Johns finally said.